And now, welcome to the Midday for a Friday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and there will be a performance tomorrow, a lecture and performance about 18th and 19th century guitars, and it's in conjunction with the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau. And bringing it all to life is my guest today, Michael Kudurka, who is with us from our Wausau studio of Wisconsin Public Radio, and welcome to the Midday.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
A great pleasure. Now, more about this performance at the museum, because you're actually a professor at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. So what brings you then exactly to Wausau?
Well, my wife is the assistant professor of flute at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. So we live in Stevens Point, and I commute to my teaching in North Carolina, which is a little bit stressful, but I'm getting lots of frequent flyer miles racked up.
Well, it's the life of the artist, right?
Yes, it is.
What about this exhibit at the museum?
This is an amazing exhibit. It's the world premiere of a new collection of instruments that are held by the National Guitar Museum. The name of the exhibition is Medieval to Metal, the Art and Evolution of the Guitar. And it's phenomenal. There are about 50 instruments in the collection, ranging from an Arabic oud, which is an instrument that's been played for about 5,000 years continuously, all the way up to the most modern electric guitars, and everything in between, Baroque lutes, classical guitars, early steel string guitars made by the Martin family, which came to the U.S. from Germany. And
sure.
It's just a phenomenal exhibition.
Let's see, should I ask, or do you even know, are these all playable instruments?
They are, actually. I had the privilege of being able to play one of the instruments a couple weeks ago. They have a Baroque theorbo, which is a kind of overgrown lute with an enormous neck extension to support these extremely long harp strings. And a couple weeks ago, with the approval of the museum director, or the exhibition director, H.P. Newquist, we took the instrument out of the case and recorded a little two-minute video of me kind of demonstrating the theorbo and showing how it works, and that video is now up on the Woodson website.
Before we actually hear the sound of the lute, I have to say that some of those instruments look very unwieldy. We were watching Wolf Hall the other night, you know, the new masterpiece series on PBS set during the time of Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell. And there's a scene in which there's a lutenist. And the first thing you notice is, well, because there are a lot of strings in there, but also that the head of the lute, for some unfathomable reason, is bent at 90 degrees to the actual bridge.
Right.
What's that about?
Right. Well, that 90-degree angle is a feature of the instrument that goes all the way back to the lute's ancestor, which is the Arabic oud. The oud has a angled neck like that. No one is entirely sure why instruments were built like that, plucked string instruments were built like that, even thousands of years ago. But I think the most likely reason is that having an angled neck provides you with a little more leverage when tuning the strings. You can imagine being able to lift a very heavy weight with a rope if it's slung over something. You know, you get sort of more leverage that way. So in order to crank the strings up to pitch, if the neck is angled, it makes it actually a lot easier to do that. And we have to remember that this is going on long before the invention of mechanical tuning pegs, which are what we see on guitars.
Good point. And what lute have you brought with you today?
Well, I have an 8-course Renaissance lute. When I say course, I mean a pair of strings, kind of like on a 12-string guitar. The player tunes these strings to a unison. But having paired strings makes for a much more resonant and shining sound. And lutes in the Renaissance were always strung up in this way.
When do you say paired, though? I mean, the same tone for these pairs, just a doubling of the tone?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a doubling. All the strings on this instrument are doubled except for the first string, which is single. And in the Renaissance, they called that first string the chanterelle, and to give the sense that it was the singing string. And so the first string will sound more like a solo voice, whereas all the other strings, because they're doubled, could sound like having two people singing in unison.
Uh-huh. Well, it certainly creates a lovely sound. And you have selected, among other things, these three Reicher cars. Is a Reicher car is sort of, is it an etude, or how would you describe a Reicher car?
It's an interesting genre in the Renaissance. A ricercar is a kind of free contrapuntal piece that comes purely out of the imagination of the composer. It's a piece that's not bound to any preconceived forms, like, say, a particular set of dance steps, like in a pavane or a galliard or something like that. And also, it's a piece that's written in a way that's not based on any pre-existing work. There were many pieces for lute that were based on songs or madrigals, but a ricercar is really not like that. It's a piece coming purely from the imagination of the composer.
So really what we'd call today, or in the 19th or even late 18th century, they'd call a fantasy.
Exactly. And even in the Renaissance, there was an interchangeable term, which was fantasia, and they're really indistinguishable.
And these are by Francesco da Milano. I seem to think he was one of the composers that Respighi used for his ancient airs and dances for orchestra.
I believe you're right.
Very atmospheric stuff. And so these are three ricercars from the year of 1562.
That's right. These were actually published posthumously by da Milano's student, Perino Fiorentino. Yes.
And here we go, the sound of the lute, Michael Kadurka playing. Some ricercar, three of them, from the year 1562, Francesco da Milano, the composer, and the guitarist Michael Kadurka. Charming, graceful stuff.
Thank you.
And how did you discover the lute? Through guitar?
Yeah. I was starting my master's degree with a a phenomenal performer and composer by the name of Dusan Bogdanovich, who was teaching at the San Francisco Conservatory at the time. And we were working on various things in terms of composition and improvisation, and, you know, learning repertoire, as any good master student in music is going to do. And he was the one who introduced me to the music of Francesco da Milano. Bogdanovich is a great lover of his music, and really appreciates the beauty and complexity, but also the clarity of his counterpoint. Da Milano is able to write for the lute in a way that really does make it sound like there are several lines of counterpoint going on at the same time, which is not an easy feat. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit easier to pull off on a keyboard when you have 10 fingers to use, but on the lute, I only have 4 fingers to hold down notes in the left hand. And Da Milano really expertly uses the resources of the lute to achieve this kind of contrapuntal writing. So I've played many pieces of his for years, really, on guitar. Only later did I get a lute and really try to play them on the lute and really reworked my technique from the ground up to develop a real lute technique, which is actually quite different from a guitar technique, as we can see from paintings from the time. The lute was held in a radically different way than the guitar. But after going through all that, I've only loved this music really more than ever.
It must be difficult, I guess, I would say, at first to play the lute with that configuration of courses, as you put them, the doubling of the strings and the wide fingerboard and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. It's a very, very different instrument. Hard to get used to. And, you know, I would actually say probably the most difficult thing to get used to is just how utterly different it sounds. For someone who has had so much training my whole life on the classical guitar, a 6-string instrument where you have the individual strings instead of paired strings, you get used to a certain quality of tone. And the lute is a much earthier instrument. It has a kind of grittier tone to it, which it takes time to get used to. But it's a very intimate and beautiful sound, and once I accustom myself to it, I really love it as a contrast to the modern classical guitar.
The pairing of the strings make it a little more difficult. I'm thinking, well, if there are people, of course, who play 12-string guitar, would they find it easier to get adjusted to the lute with those doubling strings or no?
I think they probably would, but I find that most people who play 12-string guitar nowadays are generally strumming chords. So I think that's probably the most difficult aspect of playing the lute, is that we're not just strumming through chords. I have to find the exact pair of strings with one finger in my right hand and pluck those 2 strings, and only those 2 strings, or at least hopefully only those 2 strings.
We're going to be hearing more from Michael Kadurka and his lute, and later also his guitar, when we return in a moment. This is The Midday, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. And now back to Michael Kadurka, who's joined me from our studios, our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Wausau, and he's in Wausau to be performing works for lute and guitar in conjunction with an exhibit at the Woodson Art Museum that is called, let's see, refresh my memory, is Medieval to Metal, Michael?
That's right, Medieval to Metal.
Do you play metal guitars ever?
I did when I was in high school, actually. I started playing electric guitar, as probably so many guitarists do, and really loved it. But I found after a few years of doing it, I don't want to say I was getting bored with it necessarily, but let's just say when I discovered the repertoire for the classical guitar, I found it to be so rich and challenging and inspiring and engaging that I just completely fell in love with it. And pretty rapidly decided to sell my electric guitar and the amp and all the effects pedals and get a classical guitar, and I really haven't looked back.
Have a little lighter. It's also easier to practice in a hotel room, right?
That's right.
Well, one of the names associated very strongly with Elizabethan music and with the lute, although we hear his works played almost entirely on guitar these days, I think, on various CDs, is John Dowland, who was, quite a character in his own right, but also very prolific composer.
That's right. He was a really interesting character. He was he got mixed up in a lot of the sort of violent battles going on in England between the Catholic and Protestant factions at the time. There was a lot of political turmoil. He actually had to leave England for quite a while and ended up getting rounded up by what was in effect a Catholic terrorist organization in Italy planning to attack certain areas in England. I don't think he actually followed through on any of that, but besides being a composer, he had some pretty, intense affiliations politically. Fortunately, that isn't the path that his life ended up taking, and he ended up spending most of the time composing and performing. Ended up getting a pretty nice job as the private lutenist for the King of Denmark.
Oh, yes, right, yeah. Which was he described colorfully in terms in conflict with his own morals, let's put it that way.
Right. I guess he learned how to live with it, though.
I guess so. It's part of the job. Right. He wrote, generally speaking, pieces that were pretty, let's say, subdued. He even has one that's called Semper Dowland, Semper Dolens, meaning Dowland, always grieving. And so we have, for example, this Lacrimae Pavan, the tearful pavan that you're going to play.
That's right. It was a bit of an affectation at the time to write pieces that were just as melancholic and tragic and sad as one possibly could. I can't help but wonder if it's a little bit like the kind of emo movement in popular music of the last decade, but I imagine Dowland may have been wearing a dark eyeshadow and always wearing black. I'm not sure how sincere that was or whether he was just going with the style, because this style of really, really dark and sad music was pretty common at the time, really.
So here it is, the Lacrimae Pavan.
Thank you.
Lacrimae Pavan by John Dowland, Elizabethan composer extraordinaire, and playing the lute there was Michael Kudurka, who is performing in Wausau as we speak and talking to us from there about the instruments and the exhibit that he's connected with at the Woodson Art Museum there in Wausau, Medieval to Metal. Well, let's see here. Why don't we squeak in one more, if you can get to your 18th century guitar, Michael, and then we'll have the quiz question. So 18th century guitar, is this a reproduction or actually an original 18th century guitar you're going to be playing?
This is a reproduction. This instrument was built by a really phenomenal guitar builder, a man by the name of John Currier, who actually lives in Stevens Point. He's a builder of handmade acoustic guitars, really, really extraordinary woodworker and craftsman. And this is actually the first historical instrument he made. And so I was demonstrating this instrument in my previous residency a couple weeks ago at the Woodson Art Museum, kind of showing how the Baroque guitar works and what kind of music would have been played on it. I'll be using it tonight and tomorrow to show how the Baroque guitar, or the 17th century guitar, how it changed in the 18th century and, you know, really through the 19th century, how we end up with the instrument that we now call the classical guitar, which is my primary instrument.
So is this one just slightly smaller than a contemporary or a 19th century guitar? What's the difference before you get into these two pieces by Fernando Sor?
Sure. There are a great number of differences. Probably the biggest one is that through time, a guitar gradually added strings. So in the Renaissance, the guitar, which was a very small little instrument played in Spain, had only four courses, you know, like we were talking about on the lute, these paired strings. So the Renaissance guitar, in a sense, would probably most closely resemble a ukulele today.
Oh, wow.
A four-string, a very small little four-string instrument, generally played simple music. By the Baroque era, a fifth course was added, and that's what this instrument is like. And in the classical period, the players took this five-course guitar and literally removed the paired strings, turning it into a single-strung instrument, which is what we're familiar with today, the most guitars, you know, other than 12-string guitars. And so that's what I'm going to be playing right now. I'm going to be basically showing a transitionary instrument. It's a Baroque guitar, but slightly adapted to be more like the way they would be strung up in the late 18th century with just single strings. And I think people will really hear the radical difference between what it sounds like to pluck paired strings versus single strings. It's a much clearer and less resonant but more direct kind of sound.
So these are two studies by Fernando Sor, who was Beethoven and Schubert contemporary.
That's right. Thank you.
Two studies by Fernando Sor, played on the 18th century guitar. And, well, it certainly does have a different sound from the lute, Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, too, how the sound of that instrument is so different than the classical guitar, which is studied in conservatories and universities today. The relationship between them is much like the relationship between a modern Steinway grand and a pianoforte, which
so
I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with now.
Yeah, it is quite a noticeable difference. It has a charm all of its own, though.
Yeah,
kind
absolutely.
Of an intimacy. Well, then we'll move into the world now of the 19th and 20th, maybe even the 21st century guitar, with pieces by actually a composer who was the contemporary of Fernando Sor, the one we just heard from, Mauro Giuliani, one of the big, another big proponent of the guitar in the early 19th century.
Yes, they lived at about the same time. Sor was born a little bit before Giuliani, and I think of Sor as being a slightly more conservative figure. Giuliani was a little bit more inventive and radical in terms of his use of the instrument. In particular, Sor's technique was really very much like the earlier Baroque guitar technique in that he would hold his pinky on the top of the instrument and really only use his thumb and two fingers to pluck the strings. Giuliani had the radical idea to also pluck the strings with the ring finger of the right hand, and he wrote a whole set of etudes to teach the next generation of guitarists to pluck with four fingers instead of just three.
So that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
How about that? Well, these are pieces from Rossiniana, and specifically Rossini's opera The Siege of Corinth. These are pieces inspired by that, by Mauro Giuliani.
Thank you.
of guitar specialist and Beethoven and Rossini contemporary Mauro Giuliani, and the very distinctive march to start the whole thing off, variations and finale on themes from The Siege of Corinth by Rossini, as played by Michael Gadurka. Michael Gadurka is joining me from Wausau today, from our WHRM Wisconsin Public Radio studio up there, and we will be back with him, and I'll repeat our 12:30 quiz question in a minute here on WPR. And back now with Michael Gadurka, and this time, well, we're going to stay in Spain, actually, but we will go into the early 20th century with Manuel de Falla.
Yes, this is a very interesting piece. It's the only piece de Falla ever wrote for guitar. His orchestral music is so inspired by the sound of the guitar.
Yeah.
But this is the only thing he wrote for it, and it's his homage to Claude Debussy, written just after Debussy's death.
Tributes from one composer to another, and there's more, right? Is there more? Did I cut you off, Michael?
No, that's it. I'm sorry, I was just checking my tune.
Okay. Thought we might have had a long, rest there.
Long fermata.
Yeah, that's right, long fermata. Tombeau de Claude Debussy, tombeau being an old French musical tradition, meaning a musical monument erected by one composer to another, in this case, Manuel de Falla, who was a big fan of Debussy's, actually. Well, you mentioned, I think, that at the beginning of the hour that one of your teachers was Dusan Bogdanovich, is that right?
That's right. I worked with him for 1 year in San Francisco and learned so much from him in 1 year that I'll probably spend the rest of my life trying to fully actualize all of the ideas he gave me.
Well, it seems to me the guitar music in, well, let's say, recent years, the last half of the 20th century on, has gotten dramatically more complex and varied.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think as the pedagogy for guitar is improved now that it's in major conservatories and universities. We have just a higher and higher level of performance ability, and also composers who themselves play the instrument and can therefore write in a very effective way for it.
Okay, let me ask you a possibly touchy question here. Does this music, this Latter-day music, sound less attractive than earlier music? Is it more for the aficionado, more for the performer than previous music, do you think?
I think there was a period in the mid-20th century when the schools of composition were very strictly aligned with the 12-tone serial movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that, some people love it and some people don't, but I think, really from the 1960s onward, that grip has been loosened to the point where today, I don't know of any composers that are writing in that language, and I think every composer is, genuinely trying to write something that is meaningful and beautiful in some way. So I'm very excited about the state of new music today. I'm glad I didn't live in the 1950s, because I think there was really only one way to go for new music, and it's true, a lot of people didn't like it, but I think we're free of that now.
Our titles have gotten actually better, I think. Unconscious in Brazil, certainly evocative.
That's right.
This piece from 1994 by Dusan Bogdanovic. Were you retuning the strings, some of them, as you went along there? Is that what we were hearing?
Yeah, there were actually two different kinds of retuning going on. Before I played the piece, I detuned my lowest string down by a half step. Normally, the lowest string would be an E, and I tuned it down to E flat, which really creates a totally different tonal kind of landscape for the piece than mm-hmm. standard tuning. And then also, there are some notes that are indicated in the score to have a wild and extreme vibrato, so I'll actually pluck the note and then bend the string as hard as I can parallel to the fret, raising the pitch, creating this huge pitch inflection.
It must be an interesting score to look at.
It's pretty wild.
It seems to work pretty well, though. I mean, that effect is arresting without being off-putting, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It's still a harmonic language that isn't, I wouldn't say it's always immediately accessible, and yet there is a deep logic to Dusan Bogdanovich's compositional style that for some people is appealing on a first listening, but I find for many people on repeated listenings, we find deeper and deeper layers, relationships between the sections and the lines, and overall in that piece, this sense of a growth from a simple little seed that begins to sprout and grow in complexity until it becomes this really quite wild and ornate thing at the end.
Do you ever compose or improvise?
I love improvising. I love to just sit down with the guitar and make up pieces from scratch in real time. I love improvising with friends. I have tried my hand at composition. I've written a few pieces, but I learned pretty quickly that for me to do composition justice, I would have to really devote my life to it. And I found that to be a full-time composer, I wouldn't be able to play enough. And I basically made the decision that I couldn't just sit at a desk with a pencil and paper all day. I have to be playing. I'm one of those people. I need the instrument in my hands or else I'm not entirely happy.
Well, I have heard it said recently, and it rang true, that composers really would find it useful to be performers and to be have the experience of being on stage, actually performing a piece, to have insights into, you know, what works in it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And my favorite composers to work with are people who have trained very seriously as performers at a young age, but at some point decided to become composers, and yet they've had that experience. They know what it means to play a piece in real time. They know what it means to play a piece that's meaningful for the audience. There are some composers who not only don't perform but have never performed, and I find that sometimes they will ask their performers to do things that don't entirely make sense.
There's a long tradition of that, isn't there?
Yeah.
So, have you had that experience? Have you commissioned pieces, and have you had that experience working with the composer who you say, well, you know, that's humanly impossible?
I have. And, you know, what I found is that most of the time, almost always, the composers are very excited to hear feedback from performers and are more than happy to make the changes you want. It's only very rarely that a composer in this situation will absolutely insist that it's their way or the highway. But I was working with a really wonderful Portuguese composer a few years on some pieces that were algorithmically generated. He wrote computer software that then composed the pieces. And they were phenomenal, interesting, beautiful pieces, somewhat otherworldly because they were written not by a human but by a computer. And I'll be honest, there were many technical problems with the execution, but we spent just dozens of hours going note by note and work editing it to make what I think was a really, really compelling piece in the end.
Do they have to make stronger guitars to play some of this contemporary music?
Well, I can say for myself that working on contemporary music has definitely expanded my technique in ways that if I just stuck to classical and romantic literature, I don't think I would have the technique I have today. Composers are really, really excited to push the boundaries of what the instrument can do.
You have this performance coming up. One more time about that.
Yes, my third residency at the Woodson Museum, so I'll be there tonight and tomorrow, but in May I'll be there for a final time on May 7th, 8th, and 9th. On the 7th I'll be giving a lecture on the guitar in painting and literature from the Renaissance to the present day.
Wow, neat idea.
Yeah. The next day on May 8th at 5 o'clock at the museum I'll be giving a lecture on exactly what we were just talking about, 20th and 21st century composition, this sort of new kind of language, new musical languages for the guitar. And then my final appearance will be on May 9th at the museum at 1 in the afternoon, and that'll be a performance of 20th and 21st century works for guitar.
Well, Michael Kudurka, thank you very much for joining us for the midday today from our Wausau Bureau.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure having you on the show, and look forward to hearing more.
Thank you.